Okay. Well, first of all, I want to thank Birger for inviting me and thanking all of you for showing up from all over the world. Given what Birger said in his opening remarks, in a way I'm going to begin a little bit differently than I thought I would, just to sort of connect more directly with what you were saying. This has to do with how library and information science sees itself in relation to social epistemology, and in particular, the kind of advice that philosophers are likely to be giving you, and I'm assuming most of the people in this room are actually part of the field of library and information science. I think you should take it with a certain amount of grain of salt. And I think that the way in which philosophers tend to relate to other fields is basically kind of in the way in which you might say free traders relate to third world countries. Okay. In other words, you know, they're sort of telling you, look, don't get any ideas that you yourself have, as it were, native knowledge products that you might want to actually promote from your own history. And this is why I was very happy to hear Birger picked up on that sentence that I have in the Encyclopedia article about the history of this field being very important for defining how exactly you want to understand social epistemology. Okay. Because in a sense, social epistemology, you might say, has been subject to multiple inventions, right? So the way it arose in philosophy was through total ignorance of Scherer and Egan and so forth, right? And there's no reason to think, other than a kind of word fetishism, that there's necessarily any connection between the two, right? And so in a sense, if there is a connection, it has to be a connection that in a sense you forge and that you want. But you shouldn't seem to, you shouldn't think that just because people like me and Alvin Goldman and whomever use the phrase social epistemology, that necessarily you have to be, you know, singing from our hymn sheet, even though philosophy in some sense is a kind of important field, okay? And so when I read somebody, you know, when I read somebody like Faridi, for example, I have very mixed feelings, because there's a sense in which I can see Faridi properly saying, look, you shouldn't take philosophical views of social epistemology off the shelf, as it were, and just apply them to your field. That's true. But at the same time, I'm a little worried that Faridi is really saying that you guys shouldn't really have your own social epistemology at all. That in a sense, what you guys are about is application. You're just practical guys. You shouldn't be theorizing what your field is about. You shouldn't think that you have your own knowledge products, that you have your own distinctive ontologies, your own distinctive epistemologies, and so forth. And that's what I think he's really saying, actually. And that's why I compare him to a free trader. Because a free trader wants to say, look, you guys, you're trying to protect your native products and so forth, but really now there's a big open field out there. You can get your theories from elsewhere. You can get it from epistemology more generally. You don't need your own kind of social epistemology. There's just this general philosophical field of epistemology, and you should be worrying more specifically about the practical concerns of users and libraries. And so I'm a little suspicious of his invocation of libraries in this context, because libraries aren't understood in a theorized kind of way, but it's really understood purely in a kind of practical kind of way. That's what I think he's really going after here. He's basically telling you guys, don't think about having a theory or ontology of your field. That's too big for you guys. Right? You just play into the larger field. So don't think about having your own social epistemology. Okay? And so that's why he talks about a philosophy of information. Right? And I think what you guys have got sucked into is the fact that, oh, you call your field library and information science, and here's a philosopher giving you a philosophy of information, and therefore it must be relevant. It doesn't follow. Philosophy of information is, in the first instance, a game in philosophy. Okay? And you guys could get sucked into it, but you don't need to. You can come up with your own philosophy, your own social epistemology, all the rest of it. And this is why you need to think about what has this field been about, right? And that's where the history becomes very relevant, okay? And not just the history of the term social epistemology, right? So there's a sense in which, of course, Scherer and Egan and all this kind of stuff, it's worth looking at, because actually they had some ideas. They had some interesting ideas. But really what you should be looking at is the entire history of the field of library and information science, and then thinking about what's distinctive in its approach to knowledge, right, where a notion like social epistemology ends up making sense. And try to, as it were, give a kind of explanation from within the narrative of the discipline, which may have some relationship, let's say, to pragmatism and other, kind of schools in philosophy and so forth. I'm not denying that. I'm not denying there's no relationship. But the point is, in the first instance, if you want to make a pitch for social epistemology in the way Birger's talking about, namely as a kind of foundation of the field, then you have to go back to your own history and kind of think, what is it that we're talking about knowledge, especially in a way that philosophers and sociologists and economists or whatever aren't talking about, right? Because then, in a sense, you've got a distinctive product. And I actually think you do. At least, one of the reasons why Jenna Hartel is involved in this is because in 2003, I was a visiting professor at the School of Library and Information Science at UCLA, where Jenna did her PhD, and she was the one who introduced me, basically, to the entire history of this field, and it really provides a completely different take on the nature of knowledge from what you would get from either philosophy or sociology. It's just, in a sense, I sometimes think you people don't take your own history seriously enough. You feel like you have to be going elsewhere to find foundations, okay? And so there's a sense in which, so the first thing that was very apparent to me coming from philosophy, and I think the issue here, in terms of where social epistemology is coming from in philosophy is worth saying a little bit about. I don't want to talk too much about it. But I do think, so I'm someone who is trained in the analytic tradition. I'm actually trained in this tradition I'm opposed to, okay? I'm an analytic philosopher by training from University of Pittsburgh. And the thing that was very clear from the way in which analytic philosophy was proceeding, especially in the last quarter of the 20th century, was that knowledge was understood basically as a certain kind of belief state that an individual has in relation to the world. Right? We talk about justified true belief. Right? This was the kind of mantra of analytic epistemology. And of course, if you know anything about the history of philosophy and the other schools of philosophy that were out there, continental philosophy, but also, pragmatism, a lot of this other stuff, you realize that this is, in fact, impoverished, right? And that there was a sense in which this whole focus, a kind of Cartesian-like focus on the individual, was, in a sense, really a problem with regard to philosophers coming to grips with the whole character of knowledge. That was just so in other words, for me, when I use the term social epistemology, and I still, it's a kind of a revolutionary move within philosophy, right? In other words, there's a sense in which it's against the default position of analytic philosophy, which is still very much that of René Descartes, even today. However, within analytic philosophy, social epistemology is basically taking the individual position and adding something social to it. So in other words, you accept a Cartesian standpoint, but then you say there are a lot of people. There are a lot of individuals, and we have to maybe look at their interaction, and especially if we come up with abstract economic models, that'll impress people, and they sort of move more in that direction. But where you guys, I take you guys to be coming from, which is quite different from the kind of disputes we were having in philosophy, is that you start with knowledge as a material product, in a way in which philosophers are aspiring to talk about. And sometimes we do, and I tried to, and in my book, Social Epistemology, I actually talk about knowledge as a product. I'm very explicit about that kind of thing. And that was before I knew anything about library and information science, but it was while I did know something about economics. And in a sense, this is why I think there is a kind of kindred spirit here with regard to the mentality that economics has with regard to knowledge and what this field has, which maybe should be exploited a little bit more and examined a little bit more carefully. And that's why somebody like Fritz Machloop, the economist, you probably, I hope you people have at least heard of him, who did a very important book on the study of information in the early 1980s, which was a kind of an anthology, which included Jesse Scherer and included a lot of the major figures from the second half of the 20th century in this field. I don't think it was accidental that this came out of economics, okay? Because there's a sense in which what you guys really have a clear grip on is the idea of knowledge as a material product. And I think the reason why this this idea now gets called information, and Machlup was already talking in terms of information, though, of course, he did a multi-volume work. If you know anything about Machlup's work, he did a multi-volume work about knowledge, about the material character of knowledge, how it's produced, distributed, and so forth. Some of you may know about this from the went from the 60s to when he died in the 80s. He put out these multiple volumes. Okay, and what he was doing there was to show that knowledge is materialized in many different kinds of ways. And I don't think there's been any kind of work that has really matched that since then. Okay, but that is within the remit of library and information science, it seems to me. And the key term for me, you know, that in a sense makes me want to still hold on to the notion of knowledge rather than just slip kind of blindly into the notion of information, goes back to the origin of this field and the fixation on documentation. Paul Otley, Susan Brier, these people, right? What is documentation about? Documentation is, in the first instance, a normative notion, right? It is a normative notion. It is about having the original copy, the proper copy, the corrected copy, right? That's what it's about. It's that kind of idea, okay? And in that respect, documentation feeds into the implications of the concept of knowledge, which is a normative concept, right? We call something knowledge when it has a certain kind of authority, that you should use it as a basis for your action, judgment. That is one of the characteristics of this term knowledge, okay? And so documentation shares that. Information doesn't share that. Information is a much more neutral term. It's a kind of non-normative term, okay? And the reason why documentation, I think, is kind of an important notion to go back to and hold on to is because when you look at guys like Otley in particular, Paul Otley, right?
I'm afraid that what you write is not...
Doesn't matter. You people have heard of Otley, right? And Machlup and so forth, right? Okay. I mean, by the way, I'm recording this, so I'm going to be putting this online in any case. So it doesn't... Don't worry. If you're missing anything, I just put it... I just put it there so you people have the illusion that I have some kind of order to what I'm saying. But the point about Otley, right, is that he introduces this notion of documentation because what he's really thinking about is a kind of universal conception of knowledge. Right? So in other words, there's a, he's not just looking at, the concept of documentation, whatever else you want to say about it, presupposes that there is a conceptual framework within which the documents are organized and classified. I mean, and you spend your whole career talking about classification. Why does classification matter? Classification only matters within the context of a universe of discourse, right? And so the question is, how do you define that universe? Then that determines what counts as a document, right? And so Otley is basically thinking about the universe of knowledge as a universal library, right? And a universal library that perhaps in principle could be available to everyone. And this would be a universal classification scheme. And those of you who know something about the biography of Otley in the early 20th century, right, that part of what was animating this kind of conception was the idea that because things were written in different languages and people had different copies of things and stuff like that, there was an enormous amount of miscommunication, and miscommunication leads to trouble, and trouble leads to wars, and, you know, we have World War I, and the thing is that in a sense, a kind of important political role that could be played by this emerging field of library and information science would be as providing a kind of normative standard for communication by having documents and then talking about how the documents relate to each other and all of that kind of thing. Now, you see, this whole way of thinking about knowledge is incredibly materialistic because it involves decisions about what copies of things are we talking about, et cetera, et cetera. And it really takes you, the starting point is really quite different from what philosophers who basically start from what's in your head, right? Philosophers are thinking, that knowledge is some relationship between your mind and the world, right? That the philosophers are starting somewhere else. But at the same time, it is quite obvious also that there is something called social epistemology that applies to the Otley project, because the Otley project is about the universal organization of knowledge. And that is a social epistemology in a very materialistic sense. And it's one that would be put in the service of global governance, ideally. And if you look at, you know, if you know something about Otley's history, he was very keen, you know, League of Nations, all this kind of stuff. Now, it seems to me that this is, now the interesting thing about this is this then raises all kinds of issues, because in a sense, part of what he's doing as well is he's projecting the library, which was a very familiar concept to people, right, into a kind of global space, and he was talking about how you should organize things. Organize things, in a sense, to make it universal in two senses, and these are two senses that I think philosophers, again, aren't necessarily all that sensitive to. One sense is the sense of a scheme, right? A universal scheme, right? So the document has the same place in every library, that kind of notion of universal. But then there's also universal availability, right? Which is to say that everyone should be able to have access to it, right? A sort of subject sense of universality. Right, because then one can talk about authorized copies, one can start having a kind of chain whereby people can actually get the right kinds of versions of the documents that they need. And he was talking about universality working in both of those ways. Now that also then presupposes a certain attitude toward the subject, toward the individual. And that is to say that in some sense people ought to be trained with this kind of universal consciousness. People should have a sense that there is a lot of stuff out there. And this stuff is organized in a certain kind of way. And you may have very specific needs, right, that cause you to want certain documents rather than others, but you should nevertheless have a general sense of what is already out there for you to get access to. So that requires a certain kind of education. And in a sense, you know, when we talk about library skills, that's a very degraded version of this. Right, what we nowadays call library skills, right, is a very degraded version of this, where the original idea was that you should, in fact, learn what the classification scheme is. You should know all the knowledge that's out there. And so then this raises a very interesting question about how should that knowledge be organized into the relevant classification scheme. And here, I think, you know, if you look at the way, you know, Otley is originally operating in a period where, of course, there's already some disciplinary specialization, there's no doubt about it, but certainly not at the level and intensity and in terms of the manufacture of documents that have taken place, especially since the Second World War, right? Otley's not part of that period. And in that period, what we have is twofold problem from the standpoint of what Otley's talking about. First of all, you have this enormous amount of specialization. The specialization is largely autonomously driven. In other words, librarians have nothing to do with it, right? It's coming from within the disciplines, and they're manufacturing all of these documents that librarians can barely keep track of. Okay? And so what this ends up doing is that the classification schemes increasingly, by default, get turned over to the disciplines. Okay? This causes problems. Why does this cause problems? Because of the way disciplines are structured. Okay? People like to think that disciplines divide the way they do through some sort of internal logic and so forth. But in fact, one of the things that we do know from studying the sociology of the sciences, right, is that in fact there are very strong path-dependent tendencies within disciplines. In other words, a lot of research may be produced in a given field. Okay? And from a librarian's standpoint, all of that research needs to be organized and classified and put somewhere so people could access it in principle. But the discipline itself doesn't treat all the research it produces with respect. The discipline itself only focuses on a very small percentage of all the research that's produced. 10 to 20%, really, if you look at citation counts and things like this. And in fact, academic journals are organized in such a way as to promote this tendency. And here we think about things nowadays like impact factors in journals, whereby, you know, the idea is if you publish in this journal, right, you get brownie points if you're citing stuff from the same journal, because that increases the impact factor, right? Not just you publishing with them, but you citing people who've already published with them, right? And those of you who've gone through peer review process understand this totally. And of course, this is part of the way in which the peer review process itself has been turned into a kind of proprietorship, whereby the people who are the gatekeepers in terms of, telling you which stuff is, what you can publish and what you can't publish, end up de facto owning the subject matter. Okay? Now, what all of this ends up doing, as from the standpoint, again, think about yourself as a library information scientist, from the standpoint of all the stuff that's being produced, what these tendencies do is to actually discourage people from looking at most of it. That is, in fact, the default tendency of academic culture. It is discipline-based, it is path-dependent, and it does not reward wide browsing habits. Okay? Now, this is anathema, it would seem to me, from the standpoint of how library and information science conceptualizes its subject matter. Because, in fact, it is in the business of organizing and classifying everything. All knowledge, all documents. Yet the academic culture really dismisses most of it and treats it as noise. And of course, this is where the economics of information becomes a very interesting thing for people in your field to look at. Because the way in which economists nowadays tend to justify this phenomenon is by saying, well, look, the reason why you got all this stuff that nobody ever reads is published is because it's the kind of noise to signal ratio thing. Right, you need a lot of crap in the system for people to see what's good. Right, so in other words, all of this stuff that you are dedicated to classifying and organizing because it is produced as knowledge is actually being understood as crap. And it's really only the stuff that is necessary for the people who are looking, who are very strategic, very targeted, very path-dependent, are going for. And now this has a lot of effects on how you guys operate, because this is how you guys turn into service providers. Because what happens then is you start thinking in terms of your client base in a very narrow way. You start to think, well, look, if I'm going to be a librarian or information scientist who is going to be dealing with the natural science faculty, I got to know what these guys think is important, right? And I've got to know what they really want. And I shouldn't be giving them stuff that's just going to get in the way and confuse their minds and stuff like this, even though that is actually stuff in their field. Okay? So this then, what it does is it makes a library and information science professional kind of parasitic on the normative standards of the knowledge producers, even if the knowledge producers are routinely disregarding most of the stuff that are producing as knowledge. Okay? And so from this standpoint, it seems to me, part of what the social epistemology of the library and information science, the kind of vision of, should be in some way partially antagonistic to the knowledge system as it's currently organized. So in philosophy, we have this term, orthogonality. Orthogonality is when you cross-classify something. So if the academic knowledge system is organized according to disciplines, which branch out in a certain way according to their historical trajectories and so forth, cross-classifying is looking at the stuff in terms of a different set of concepts that don't just run in parallel with the academic knowledge producers. Now, how you do that is, of course, up to you. It's a very interesting, challenging kind of idea. But in fact, this is how, in a sense, you could start to manufacture what we normally call interdisciplinarity, by having a cross-cutting way of classifying material that just doesn't reproduce the already existing knowledge structures within academia. Now that would seem to be something worthy of the title social epistemology within library and information science that is not being done by philosophers, sociologists, economists, or anyone else. Okay? Now, Berger mentioned in his talk that I make a big deal about Donald Swanson, the University of Chicago library and information scientist, who in the 1980s, came up with this idea of undiscovered public knowledge. And he was talking about exactly what I'm talking about. And he actually came to this in a practical context, because he was thinking in the 1980s, right, that one of the reasons why a lot of problems aren't being, practical problems, let's say, in the medical sciences aren't being solved is because people are reading the literature too narrowly. And they're being reinforced in that way because of the way they're trained professionally. And so what you really need to do, if you really want to solve potentially what you want to do to solve problems, is you have to read across literatures, and you have to bring together two fields that perhaps don't often communicate with each other. And he did this himself. Now, this is a man, Donald Swanson, who was originally trained in physics. He is not a medical scientist. He doesn't have a medical science background, but he's able to read. He's a smart guy. He's at the University of Chicago, all this kind of stuff, right? And so he read literature in dietetics and literature in physiology, and he put the knowledge from these two fields together and came up with some hypotheses, which turned out to be correct, concerning Raynaud's syndrome, about why the fingertips get cold under certain circumstances, what are the vitamin deficiencies or whatever involved. This was a long-standing mystery, and he just said, well, look, you know, if you put this knowledge together with this knowledge together and you test it out, you might get somewhere. And indeed, they did. Okay? It's a simple example, but you can imagine this has enormous kind of general sorts of ramifications, it seems to me. Especially when we're looking at vast amounts of literature being produced that, first of all, are not only being ignored within the fields that they come from, but have probably no chance of being seen from by people who are outside the fields. Okay? So we're talking, you know, so and why is this important? Well, because it's important because we actually seem to operate on the assumption that if we want to solve both intellectual problems and practical problems, we always need more research. Right? We need more research. And when people want to do more research, right, they have to write research grants, research proposals, and they have to include a literature review, right? Everybody's got to include a literature review. Literature reviews are very perfunctory things as they exist at the moment. Okay? This is the Library and Information Science investment in research is at the literature review level, it seems to me. And it's at this level where things are the worst, right? What are literature reviews? They're basically ways of preventing a nasty peer reviewer from taking your grant down. That's the sole function of a literature review. It's like an immunization system, right? Where you basically are giving credit in advance, right, to powerful people who probably couldn't give a, you know, couldn't care less about your research, but if you didn't cite them, they'd kill you, right? That's what a literature review does. It's an immunization system. It serves no other epistemological function. But in fact, from a library and information science standpoint, that's where all the action should be, right? You, before you start, you know, licensing the spending of millions, billions of dollars, right, you should see whether people are actually fully acquainted with the literature of the fields in which they intend to make a contribution. And there's a lot of stuff in that, in those fields. And actually reading about them and learning about them is a lot cheaper than having other people reinvent the wheel out of ignorance. Okay? So this is one way, I would say, in which this field, under the guise of social epistemology in its own terms, could actually make a big impact in terms of reorienting the research culture, which at the moment I think is incredibly wasteful. And its waste and its wastefulness is indicative of the low standing that your field is currently in. Because if they actually took more seriously that there is all this knowledge out there, that there are people who are concerned about organizing and classifying in all its ways, they would not act this way. But in fact, academics do not take knowledge seriously. For academics, most knowledge, and this is where everybody's kind of moved into a kind of natural, what we call natural science mode, where the publication side of academic knowledge is just kind of a license. It's just kind of something you put out there to claim a property right or something like that. It doesn't have any intrinsic value. That's why stuff's written so poorly, for example. Right? There's no value placed on the knowledge product itself. In other words, no value placed on the document. Everything's just treated as a license to move forward. Now, you see, this kind of orientation toward knowledge that I think is very endemic in the research culture that we have today is anathema to what I think was behind the animating spirit of somebody like Paul Otley in the beginning of the 20th century. Okay? And what we have had as a result of people ignoring this is that we have had we've had enormous amounts of knowledge produced, right? Most of it is, in fact, proprietary, and that is to say, in order to get access to it, you have to have a lot of prior knowledge in order to get there. And most of it, in fact, turns out to be ignored. So in a sense, we're living in kind of the worst possible outcome situation from the kind of universalist ambitions of something like library and information science in the beginning of the 20th century. Okay? Now, there is more I could say about this, but I see I have spoken for about 30 minutes, and I want to give some time for questions and issues to be raised, because what I think I've been trying to do here is, in a sense, to say that you do need to reclaim the notion of social epistemology, and you need to reclaim it from your own history, and you have to get a sense of what this history has been about, and the way in which the academic culture in which we currently live goes in very strong respects against what this field originally stood for. And so unless you want to continue to get reduced to being a service provider to whoever happens to be the most powerful clientele for knowledge today, you have got to regain the momentum here. And I do think the phrase social epistemology, because it has a kind of independent foundation in people like Shara and Egan, is a good place to start from. But you have to ground it in your own history and deal with it critically with regard to the practices that we see in the academic culture today. And I'll stop here and open up to questions. Thank you. Come on. There must be something here. Yes.
With the point grid, you bring things together that can never become each other or integrate, but together can lead to new knowledge, understanding, meaning.
Yes.
And I was grateful to our professor, Professor De Beer, who, when our undergraduate model still included a lot on what is science, society, information, knowledge, the relationship of all these together.
Right. Yes.
Your own
Well, okay. First of all, let me put your mind at ease. I wasn't trying to be exclusively practical, but there's nothing wrong with being practical. look, I mean, obviously this has to, social epistemology, and I would say this basically any academic field, to be perfectly honest, including philosophy, should be moving on theoretical and practical fronts at once, okay? And part of what I was, and in fact, I think, you know, part of the, I mean, the business about Swan, I mean, I think there's a sense in which I think, I mean, the Swanson case is usually presented, I guess, in terms of the way in which the history of this field is taught as a kind of mostly a practical lesson. But actually, when I read it, I saw it as an incredibly theoretically rich possibility. And so one of the things, you know, that I mentioned in passing in the talk was this idea of cross-classifying knowledge. So in other words, do not just follow the disciplinary structures of academia, but in fact, come up with other concepts that will pick up all sorts of knowledge within the academic culture that the academics themselves tend to neglect, right? That, in fact, is quite a critical sort of practice to the way in which academics operate by default. And there are ways, and one could theorize this, of course, there's going to be plenty of room for theory here, right? In a sense, whenever we're talking about a science that has universalist ambitions, there is going to be theorizing, okay? But the theorizing is going to have to come from, in a sense, how you see the relationship between the phenomena that you consider yourselves to be involved with, namely the knowledge base, and the way in which it's currently being used. And what you might want to do is problematize the way in which, you know, your normal clients use their own knowledge base, right? So in a sense, you end up having a somewhat oppositional position with regard to the academics who would be coming to you for help. So there is a kind of very strong critical, you know, in the context of the current academic culture, I see library and information science as quite a critical science, actually. Because what I am proposing here, because this undiscovered public knowledge stuff that Swanson came up with was not isolated. It's not isolated. It's everywhere. It's just there's no incentive to look for it. And this is the thing that needs to be problematized, the lack of incentive for people to realize just how much of the knowledge out there isn't being fully utilized. Okay? Now, there's a practical element to this issue, and there's a theoretical element to this issue, and all of them need to be pursued. What I am trying to discourage, if I'm trying to discourage anything here, is to just take theories off the shelf. Okay? There is enough going on, it seems to me, in terms of the way in which knowledge is being produced and the way in which it is being used that is problematic in the world in which we live, in the academic culture, that there is plenty there to theorize about. You don't need to have to read Foucault or God knows what people read in this field, right? You don't need to read any of that. You really just need to get a clearer sense of the relationship between the stuff that you are officially about, which is about knowledge as a whole, and the way in which knowledge is being used. And there is no philosophy or sociology off the shelf that really is so directly concerned with this matter. But there are clues from your own history about this. And Swanson is an important one. That's all I'm saying. Yeah, Philippa.
Levels. I mean, documents as probes and individual actions.
and education and how they impact on individual action, understood as a knowledge probe.
Sure.
And I would say that that allows information studies to talk on equal footing with more to wider concerns as such as economics and that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, look, when I wrote the book Social Epistemology, that was kind of what I was thinking about, right? Because if you look at the way I talk about knowledge, right, I talk about knowledge products in a very explicit kind of way, but it's also obviously in relation to individual actions and so forth. And in fact, it's that kind of conception that actually made me feel a kind of kindred spirit with the library and information science field, because I saw that there was already a similar kind of concern there. That's true. But see, I think one of the things in terms of, because there is an issue about what is the mission of the person who is in this field, right? A library and information scientist, other than being a service provider. And this is where I always have been very struck by the kind of Otley vision that, in a sense, the library and information science is a kind of educator, right? Is a person who's trying to educate, the user in a way that they end up having a broader sense of what it is that they're interested in, right? That, in a sense, they may come in too narrowly focused. And what the library and information scientist can do is say, look, you know, you need to think about this in a different way, in a more lateral way, as we might say, you know, so that you actually see connections between things that you might not have seen otherwise. Okay? And so I think that, you know, I think that was kind of part of Otley's vision of having a kind of universal classification system, was to kind of change the relationship between the way in which the librarian and information science person, you know, kind of made it kind of put it at the same level as a teacher, as an educator.
When the Science Citation Index was first published, it was interdisciplinary. One of Garfield's visions was that science would be more interdisciplinary, that scientists would not just look in their own field, but use interdisciplinary. And we have a lot of different tools. We have Google today, and
but they reinforce your biases. Google is, in a way, a nightmare for this, right? Because Google, all of these search engines that Silicon Valley produces is basically in the business of trying to make the user more predictable, for various financial reasons, mostly, right? So the point is, you end up getting your preferences reinforced, which, you know, in a way, spreads this problem of path dependency that we already see in academia across your entire life. Right, so whatever kind of breadth you might have had in amateur realms and so forth that caused you to look around lots of things because you didn't have any kind of professional commitment to them, that's disappearing too because of all of these search engines. Right, so you know, and so in a sense, the search engine phenomena doesn't help things. And with regard to Garfield and the Science Citation Index, that may have been what he wanted, but in a way, this sort of shows you. You know, so Garfield, as you may know, was a chemist, right? He's not a librarian information science person. I think what he did not realize was that there is actually a normative dimension that is required to be, people need to be trained in order to actually be able and to be willing to use the full range of information that is made available to them. This is not a natural thing for people. Right? There's a sense in which when you create these universes of knowledge, you shouldn't just assume that if it's out there, people will just use it. And no, they will tend to find what they're already interested in it. And if they're being reinforced for doing that, then in fact, most of the stuff that you've made available will go neglected. Okay? So this is where you actually need education to, you know, broaden people's horizons. So they actually are able to use the full range of knowledge that is being made available to them. Yes? Yes?
Open access, to get away from all these analytics and metrics, the information about knowledge that you're talking about rather than knowledge about knowledge, do you think that open access is a possible...
Okay, there are two things to say about that. That's a good question. I mean, one issue is, at the moment, open access is only open to those... if we're talking about open access with regard to academic journals, things like that, in that sense of...
No, I was thinking more about repositories, academia, non-peer review.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, yeah, okay. Because, you know, the problem with open access on the academic side is it's still people need to pay, you know, in one way or another. I mean, usually by having the knowledge to be able to access the materials. That's another matter. I think at the end of the day, it's the search engines are a real issue here in terms of preventing open access from being as open as it could be. Because as long as search engine, the algorithms in the search engines are designed to reinforce the biases of the user, then you could put all the knowledge out there and make it as free as possible and make it as easy to understand as possible. There will never be the prompts or the incentives for you to actually get to it. Right? So there is a problem that, and this is a Silicon Valley problem, right? That Silicon Valley, you know, is the construction of the algorithms behind the search engines. This can end up making a nightmare out of any attempts to make things more open. You see, and this is something library and information scientists need to be fighting because of the fact that it defends universal knowledge. And it needs to contest a lot of the rhetoric from Silicon Valley, which makes it look like they're the, you know, they're the champions of this. Yes, there was someone else over here. Yeah.
This is the last question before coffee break.
Okay. Oh, there's a lot of things to be said about that. I have a very mixed view about Wikipedia. And of course, if you look at my entry, they haven't treated me kindly. But that's not the only reason. But there's a sense in which you kind of learn something about it by the way it operates. Wikipedia is the kind of knowledge system you get in something approximating a free market where there are minimal rules, okay? You see, one of the things about, let's say, Encyclopedia Britannica that makes it different is that even though, I mean, the historical tendency in Encyclopedia Britannica, for those of you who don't know, right, was to have some notable person in a given field write the kind of, you know, composite essay about what the field's about. Now, what you got there wasn't just expertise, because what you got often was a lot of judgment being made. But part of what was going on was you got a really clear sense of what the universe is of this topic, of this concept. And you got a sense, perhaps, of what the author liked and didn't like. But the point is you got a sense of what was out there being thought about an issue. Okay? Wikipedia is operating fundamentally on the idea that if something's worth thinking about, someone will actually write the entry in Wikipedia and add something to it. And if somebody is not contributing, then it's not there, right? So in other words, there is no aspiration on the part of Wikipedia to be comprehensive in any kind of conceptual sense. It is basically, you know, if there's an entry, let's say, on a library, the title library, it's a kind of placeholder, right? And people will fill it with stuff. And as long as people are abiding by the relatively minimal rules that they've got, right, no point of view, verifiability, right, what's the other one? No original research. Oh, that's an interesting one, right? Right. What you end up, you know, anything that conforms to that makes it and stays there, right? And then any other norms that people want to add actually are often contested in their talk pages. You know, someone says, well, this is not a reputable source. What do you mean it's not a reputable source? It's published in this important, in this important book, you know, that's published by this major publisher. Why isn't this a reputable source, right? And then it just depends on what passes. It's a kind of free market environment for producing knowledge. Now, if you're a big believer in the free market, of course, you will say over time it self-corrects, right? This is the great argument about Wikipedia. That it self-corrects over time, and it'll even be better than anything the Encyclopedia Britannica could ever have aspired to, if you give it enough time. And people do say, the entries are improving, blah, blah, blah. But the thing that's interesting, of course, is in the meanwhile, Wikipedia, now for more than 10 years, has become the most widely cited reference source. It is the first port of call for people. So while all of this self-correction is going on, it's nevertheless carrying a lot of authority along the way. Okay? And so then you have to wonder what kind of damage might be being done that way. And it's very much kind of like, you know, the implications of free market stuff generally for society, right? That in a sense, you know, over time, if you wait long enough and you can survive the system, it gets kind of better, right? But meanwhile, a lot of lives are going to be damaged along the way. And it seems to me this is the way Wikipedia operates. Okay, so this is why I have this very mixed judgment about the matter. What I tell students, I mean, as a practical point, is I tend to think that the references in Wikipedia are good, that people should follow those, but they shouldn't pay too much attention to the text. That would be my general view. Okay? All right, thank you, everybody.